Thank you, friends, for coming. I'm so delighted to have you here together tonight, the night after the President's State of the Union remarks. My name is Sunny Miller. We're here at the beautifully restored Woman Hill Friends Meeting House at the gracious offer of our friends at Woman Hill. And it's always a delight to collaborate with our friends here on the Hill. We had Scott Reeder here in June of 2005 saying the war at that time was already on against Iraq with illegal funding of the Mujahideen al-Khalq, the MEK, in Iran. And so here we are to get an update. Scott Reeder, as you know, was a UN weapons inspector on the ground in Iraq for 7 years, from 1991 to 98. He had the real scoop. There were no weapons in Iraq. Congress didn't want to listen. They didn't want to hear it. We, in Greenfield, wrote handwritten letters, 500 letters we faxed to Congress asking for Scott Reeder to testify before the Foreign Relations Committee. It didn't happen because they didn't want to know. So we're very excited. His new book is called Target Iran, The Truth About White House Plans for Regime Change. Please give a warm round of applause for Scott Reeder.
Thanks. Well, thanks for the warm welcome. I have to take note, though, that when the president spoke last night, you know, he got warm applause after almost every line, too. So I hope this is genuine. but it's a pleasure to be here tonight to talk with you about, unfortunately, a subject which isn't very pleasant to talk about. We have a couple subjects, actually, but I'm going to lump it into one, and that is it's America's Middle East policy. You know, we have a lot of people that sit here and are focused on Iraq, and we see this with the Congress today. Congress is a lot of action in Congress right now about Iraq and where do we head with Iraq. Do we cut funding? How do we oppose a surge? Do we support a surge? Et cetera, et cetera. Not so much discussion in Congress about Iran. Even though Iran seems to be a conflict that is no longer, you know, somewhere over the horizon, it's right there on the horizon. It might even be on this side of the horizon coming right at us. But if you listen to the president's speech last night, he talked about other aspects of the Middle East as well. He talked about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. He continues to invoke the horrors of September 11, 2001 as justifying all that his administration does out of the kindness of their hearts to look after the welfare of the American people. He talks about Hezbollah in Lebanon. And it probably shouldn't be surprising that he links a Sunni Islamic fundamentalist named Osama bin Laden with a Shia movement called Hezbollah. And the majority of Americans sit there and go, oh, yeah, they're one and the same. It's the same thing. It's the same problem. That's the argument the president makes. Why? Because the president isn't the business of talking about the nuances and complexities of the Middle East. He's in the business of selling an American policy direction that speaks of regional transformation in the entire Middle East. He doesn't want to talk about the differences between Sunni and Shia. God forbid you talk about the differences between Arab and Persian. That would truly complicate things. Then you bring in the Afghans, which are a completely different element, and you know, suddenly we need a PhD to actually get into what's actually transpiring in the Middle East. No. Now, I was told by a general once when I was standing before him trying to explain why something happened. I was absolutely correct, as all lieutenants are when they're in front of generals. But he sat there and listened to me for a little while, and he said, Reeder, shut up. When you're explaining, son, you're losing. See, when a politician has to explain something, he or she has lost. You don't want to have to stand in front of a constituency and explain something to them. You want to keep it as simple as possible because most constituencies have a very limited attention span. So you simplify, simplify, simplify. And the complexities that is the Middle East has been simplified into a singular policy of regional transformation set forth and a document known as the National Security Strategy of the United States of America, initially promulgated in September 2002, most recently updated in a March 2006 version. This document is derived from Cold War era politics, where the United States was embarked in a black and white good versus evil struggle with the evil empire. Back then, we talked about, you know, American involvement on a global scale, and nobody blinked about it. I mean, we were involved everywhere because we were confronting the evil empire. Now the evil empire collapses, thanks to Gorbachev, perestroika, and the economic inefficiencies of the Marxist-Leninist system, apparently, as at least implemented by the Soviets. And you have these American ideologues who had come into power during the decades of the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. You can call them ideologues, whatever, but they're basically an expression of what Eisenhower warned us about, the military-industrial complex. These are people who used perpetual conflict with the Soviet Union. Even if it wasn't a hot war, it produced more weaponry than any hot war ever would. They used this perpetual conflict with the Soviet Union as a means of empowerment. Now that the Soviet Union is gone, they no longer have a vehicle of empowerment. They need something new, so they come up with a new ideology that basically revolves around the concept of, now that the Soviet Union is gone, the United States must step into the vacuum created by the collapse of the Soviet Union to ensure that no power or alliance of powers can ever come together to oppose us in the manner that the Soviet Union had done. They said that America needs to divide the world into spheres of strategic interest, and then we need to impose our will on these spheres of interest through economic means, political means, military means. And when we speak of military means, remember, the only thing that counts for those who formulated this policy is the national self-interest of the United States of America. So it says that international law and treaties are no longer binding. These were the tools of confrontation with the Soviet Union. That's why we entered into certain treaties. That's why we entered into agreements. But now that the Soviet Union is gone, why should we tie our hands by allowing treaties to hold us back? No, the United States, they said, will impose its will free of the constraints of international law. With disregard for international law, the United Nations is no longer a driving factor. Only what counts for America is what is going to be applied here. And the end result is, we had in 1992, back when our good friend Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense, a defense policy review process led by none other than Paul Wolfowitz and Scooter Libby, and they drafted up a defense vision paper. Fortunately, at that time, we had a president, George Herbert Walker Bush, who wasn't one of these cold warriors. He was a pragmatic man. You can disagree with his policies. You cannot think highly of him. I happen to think that the man wasn't all that bad. You know, after all, he's a guy who oversaw the peaceful dissolution of the Warsaw Pact. He oversaw the peaceful dissolution of the Soviet Union. He oversaw the peaceful reunification of Germany. He was doing something right. Something right. And yet, everything he did was seen as wrong in the eyes of the neoconservative ideologues who were looking for global domination, global hegemony. These ideologues resided in the Pentagon. George Herbert Walker Bush, if you talk to, there's a gentleman out there, some of you might be familiar with, Ray McGovern, who's a heck of a guy, former CIA analyst. He used to actually write papers and give briefings to George Herbert Walker Bush, President 41. And he has a note that he's shown me where the president talks about the crazies in the basement. He's talking about, of course, the neoconservative ideologues. He said they're a reality. We can't walk away from them because they represent a political base, but they're the crazies who we keep in the basement. The problem is that these crazies came out of the basement. All right? The crazies were kept in the basement when you had a Republican president named George Herbert Walker Bush. What you saw is that these crazies put forward this policy paper as a draft. It got leaked to the New York Times, and the United States Congress read it and said something that was quite startling today. This is un-American, they said. The drive to global hegemony that's wrapped up in this document is un-American. If you remember, George Herbert Walker Bush talked about, you know, a the words are escaping me, somebody can correct me here, but a new world order, I think, is the terminology that he was using. But he was talking about an effective interface, not opposing, not dominating, not imposing your will, an effective interface between the United States and the international community in the aftermath of the Soviet Union, that we could reach out and work together with the global community, with America in a leadership position, but still working with others to achieve some sort of balance in the world. This was his vision. That's not what the neoconservatives wanted. They wanted America to impose its will. Now, they never had that decisive fight between George Herbert Walker Bush and the moderate pragmatists in the Republican Party and the neoconservative ideologues, because in 1992, Bill Clinton won the White House. And what happened is George Herbert Walker Bush went down in history as the man who said, "Read my lips, no new taxes," and then he worked with Congress and increased taxes, and the Republicans cut him off at the knees and hated him ever since. The neoconservatives went off and festered for 8 years in think tanks, where they took this rejected 1992 policy and turned it into something which became a vision statement for an organization called the Project for a New American Century. In 1997, they pretty much published this document verbatim. The 1992 document became the 1997 vision statement. Ladies and gentlemen, if you read the 2002 National Security Strategy of the United States, it's almost a word-for-word adaptation of the 1997 vision statement of the Project for a New American Century, which is in itself an extension of the 1992 rejected defense policy posture statement. This is where we are today. The neoconservatives have won. They are victorious. Now, how does this relate to the Middle East? Don't for a second try to isolate Iraq from Iran from Afghanistan. There's a reason why the president talks about the global war on terror. It's simple, and it is readily reflective of the policy direction that the ideologues who dominate the foreign policy decision-making hierarchy of the United States want America to head in. A global war on terror gives us all the tools we need to impose our will on our terms to the rest of the world. You are either with us or you are against us. This is a policy the president articulated in the aftermath of September 11, 2001, and it's a policy that still drives how he sees America interfacing with the rest of the world as we speak. Think about it. This is a president, and indeed there are many Americans who endorse this, who believes that 300 million people, that's the population of the United States of America, gets to dictate the terms of coexistence with over a dozen billion people in the world today. 300 million people get to dictate the terms of coexistence with everybody else. They have no say. We're the only ones with a vote. The president, as part of this policy, has created a strategic region of national interest in the Middle East. They have a policy objective in the Middle East called regional transformation. Governments that have been identified by this administration as either being failed in nature or rogue states have been targeted for elimination. This is a singular policy objective. Iraq was simply the initiating act of this policy. There is no distinguishing Iraq with Iran in the mind of this president. This president and those who support his policies have bought into an overall policy objective and direction of regional transformation throughout the region. Because it's not just Iran, it's Syria. And I'll tell you what, if your name is Hosni Mubarak, you need to be concerned, because it's Egypt as well. And if you're the House of Saud, you need to be concerned, because it is Saudi Arabia. And God help you if you're the king of Jordan. There's a recognition that this too shall pass, because a monarchy is not reflective of the democratic ideals that America seeks to impose on the Middle East. Are we doing this because we love the Arab people? Are we doing this because we truly want secular Muslim states to thrive in the Middle East? No. We're doing that out of America, what's deemed as American national interests, which in that area of the world revolve around energy supplies and how America can impose its will on energy supplies, both in terms of guaranteeing a continuous flow of oil at economically viable prices to the American economic machine, and controlling the flow of oil to developing economies around the world, primarily China and India. We want to dictate the pace of their economic growth so that we can control their potential to pose a threat to us. This is the strategic vision. But there's also another elephant in this room. Israel. This is all about defending the state of Israel. Now, I have no problem with defending the state of Israel. I believe that Israel is a nation that is worthy of being defended. In 1948, the international community voted for the existence, the creation and the existence of the state of Israel. And we should ensure that the will of the international community is played out. But you know, it's an uncomfortable birth. David Ben-Gurion himself said, if I were a Palestinian, I'd oppose the state of Israel because it is created by tearing land away from the Palestinian people. It's a difficult birth. There are difficult problems. But just because you support Israel doesn't mean that Israel is always right. Unfortunately, our policy objective, again, an outgrowth of the Cold War politics of the time that had the United States supporting Israel because Israel was a bastion of Western-style democracy and a sea of Arab nationalism that was leaning dangerously towards the Soviet bloc. Today, it's taken on a higher meaning, so to speak. You have America's policies with Israel confused with right-wing Christian movements in the United States that somehow believe in the rapture, in Armageddon, the coming of Jesus, the return of Jesus, and there can't be a return of Jesus unless there is a viable Israeli state that's inclusive of biblical Israel. So you have American Christians who are actually behind the notion of Zionistic expansion in the Middle East. Unfortunately, these Christians compose what is called the Christian Right, which is a major plank holder in the foundation of Republican Party politics, and therefore their beliefs impose themselves on our policy decisions that we make. When you talk about Iran, remember this. The current struggle in Iran is not just reflective of an American ideology put forward by these neoconservative ideologues of regional transformation. It is also very much part of an Israeli position that they cannot tolerate a resurgent Iran that possesses technology that gives it the ability to have nuclear weapons. The Israelis have drawn a red line in the sand and said, Iran shall not cross this red line. And they have told the United States that the United States has an obligation to deal with the Iranian threat. So we see the United States predisposed towards aggression against Iran. But what's dictating the accelerated timeline isn't the people who are pushing this policy, but the Israeli lobby that's saying we have to act now. And the combination of the two is creating the situation in which this president believes he has the mandate to wage war against Iran as we speak. This president believes that he has already received all the permission necessary from the United States Congress to carry out this war. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to tell you, he is right. He is correct. Because in the aftermath of September 11, 2001, the United States Congress on September 14th passed a War Powers Authorization resolution that gave the president not only the means to use military force against those who perpetrated the events of September 11th, but any nation who has been defined by the United States as providing safe harbor, assistance, or facilitation to individuals and organizations involved in these acts. Listen to the president's speech last night. He clearly links Osama bin Laden with Iran. And there was not a single voice of opposition from the United States Congress. And then you take a look at the War Powers Authority granted by Congress to the president in October of 2002, and it says War Powers Authorization for Iraq, but read it very carefully, because within the language of that document, once again, is raised the specter of America's global war on terror and the inherent duties and responsibilities, indeed obligation, of this president to protect us from state sponsors of terror. Why did I mention the National Security Strategy of the United States, March 2006? Because Iran is listed no less than 14 times as the number one threat to the national security of the United States of America, not only in terms of a nuclear weapons program that has yet to be shown to exist, The document says even if Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapons program, it still constitutes the number one threat because it is the single greatest state sponsor of terror in the world today, and Congress has yet to question this document. So with Congress unquestioning a statement made by the president in the National Security Strategy of the United States of America, that leaves the president free to define the terms that he is using. And again, with Congress giving him the authority to strike those persons and organizations who are involved with the concept of terror, he has a green light to strike Iran. And he's going to do so very soon, unless something is done to stop him. To me, the window of strike opportunity opens in March. That's when we'll have that third carrier battle group, the third one. You haven't heard too much talk about it. You're just thinking two right now. You got the Eisenhower and you got the Stennis coming in. Well, USS Ronald Reagan is going to be surging out of San Diego sometime in February, arriving off the coast of Iran in early March. That now gives you the ability to have three carrier battle groups with all the aircraft that are involved. It gives you the ability to project sustainable air power over Iranian airspace so that American air power can be projected from bases here in the United States of America, B-2 bombers, B-52 bombers, B-1 bombers, and Iran can be bombed into submission, or so the plan goes. The plan may not work. What happens then? Ground troops. Well, we don't have enough ground troops. We got plenty of ground troops. We got more than enough ground troops. We don't have enough ground troops to do long-term sustainment of military projection of power. But, you know, we got 130,000, 140,000 troops in Iraq as we speak. There's another 140,000 that are preparing to go to Iraq. Then there's another 140,000 just came out of Iraq that could go back in. So there's 280,000 troops out there that can be brought into this conflict. We have the troops. We just can't keep them in Iraq forever. So the war would have to be conducted. If we go to war with Iran, we have now compressed the time frame for victory into a very small space. We have to achieve victory sooner rather than later. And what happens if these troops can't achieve victory in the time frame set forth by the president? Now we have to escalate it to the next level. Well, we just used America's conventional air power. We've now exhausted America's conventional ground power. What's left? Oh, yeah, that's right. This is the same president, the same administration, the same Congress, and I'll keep bringing this up, the same Congress that has created what is known as not only usable nuclear weapons. I hate that term because it means they're going to use them. These are usable nuclear weapons, but a nuclear implementation policy that allows the United States, for the first time since the end of the Second World War, to consider the use of nuclear weapons preemptively in a non-nuclear situation. That means that if a threat emerges, we can nuke them. We don't have to wait for someone to nuke us. We don't have to wait for someone to develop a nuclear capability or a WMD capability. We just nuke them. And I would think having 200,000 American troops in harm's way in Iran with no cavalry over the hill to come and rescue them would represent a condition under which this president would encourage the preemptive use of nuclear weapons. Ladies and gentlemen, we're on the edge of the abyss. We can sit here and talk about Iraq all we want. Congress can sit here and talk about all the non-binding resolutions they want. We can even talk about defunding the surge of American troops. But the bottom line is, this Congress has so abrogated its responsibilities of oversight that it has diluted whatever power it once had to affect American foreign and national security policy. And unless this Congress somehow awakens, there's no hope of preventing armed conflict with Iran. Because here's the most devastating statement I'm going to make here tonight. We'd like to believe in America the notion of we the people, the power of the people, means something. We have a president now who has publicly stated that he doesn't care about polls. He's not going to allow the winds of public opinion to affect his unilateral decision-making when it comes to national security of the United States of America. And he has not been challenged by Congress. Now, there are three branches of government out there. There is the executive, the president, the legislative Congress, and then there's the judiciary. The judiciary has already said that it will not get involved in issues of foreign policy and national security. That's not its business. Its job is to interpret the Constitution. But if the Congress of the United States abrogates its constitutional powers to a unitary executive, the judiciary cannot impose and say, stop, Congress, you've got to do your job. Well, Congress has abrogated its responsibilities. Congress is not acting. The only power Congress has left, thanks to its transfer of power to a unitary executive, is the power of the purse. So when we speak of what can we do, the only thing we can do is to somehow implore our representatives to invoke the power of the purse. They can't stop the president from attacking Iran, but they certainly can say, you're not going to attack it with U.S. taxpayer money. The Boland Amendment in 1982 put limitations on U.S. taxpayers' money used by the United States government in terms of overt and covert actions against Nicaragua. And there was a crisis when President Reagan went around the Boland Amendment. Remember that old, arms for the Iran-Contra affair, hostages, arms, money, little shell game going on with Ollie North running around, funneling money in. Well, Congress, in the end, dropped the ball because this was a constitutional crisis. This is one that should have brought a presidency down with people going to jail. Didn't happen. That was the deep slide right there. It's one of the big areas where Congress punted on the issue of power of the purse. Well, it's time Congress come back and re-engage this unilateral executive on the issue of the power of the purse. The only way to stop a war with Iran, ladies and gentlemen, is to regain control of the money the president would have to use to attack Iran. A Boland Amendment that prohibits the expenditure of U.S. taxpayers' dollars, again, for any action, covert or overt, against Iran without the express permission of the United States Congress. Without the express permission of the United States Congress, is the only way to stop this war. If you think for a second Congress is going to hold a hearing on Iran that is meaningful, you haven't been listening to Congress lately. All these people that say, well, Democrats are in power. Take the top 20 Democrats. Pick the 20 most powerful Democrats you can come up with. And tell me what percentage of them attend annual American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee meetings. About 80% of them. And read the speeches they give at these AIPAC meetings. They're not speeches warning the Israeli lobby to take it easy, don't tread on America. They're speeches embracing the policies put forward by the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. So if you're looking for Democrats in Congress to do the right thing, just on their own volition, it won't happen. Go back and take a look at the statements made by Nancy Pelosi and others in July and August of 2006 when Israel was engaged in a conflict with Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Not only did they praise the Israeli actions, but they linked the Israeli actions against Hezbollah to a larger effort to oppose irresponsible Iranian expansion. Congress is predisposed towards conflict with Iran. That's the situation we find ourselves in. While we are focused on Iraq, we have an even bigger problem brewing over the horizon. As I said, it's no longer over the horizon. It's done crested the hill, and it's starting to roll straight at us, picking up momentum every day that goes by. So that's my intelligence report to you. I'm sorry it's so pessimistic. Now I'll take any questions anybody has. Thanks.